May 9, 2003. Dear Dad, I know that we have had our differences and everything, but I want you to know how much I really love you and respect you. I never felt that you were wrong in anything you were saying, only that I had to learn everything you know on my own, even if it hurts sometimes. I really appreciate all that you have done for me and taught me over the years and think that it will come in handy in the long run. Things are going well over here. The people are glad that Saddam Hussein is no longer in power. Some of the Iraqis who are Sunnis are not as sure about what is going to happen because most of the people in this part of Iraq are Shiites. The civil affairs guys will have a larger and larger role now that the fighting is over. There are still some disturbances going on, but I think they are just the die-hard fanatics. There is also a lot of looting going on. Jamil, the old man who works in our tent, says that there are not many jobs available. As soon as we get into the rebuilding, there will be plenty of jobs and then democracy will really kick in and we win the peace as quickly as we won the war. At least that's what the officers are saying and I kind of believe them. Please take care of Mom and don't let her worry too much. I'm bunking down in the bubble, which is the safe zone, and it is nowhere near the areas where the Iraqis can get at us. Also, the only people who do regular patrols are the infantry and the Marines and some special forces guys. Most of the time I play Bad Whist or watch television. Easy life, right? Your loving son, Robin. Anytime a guy gets a large package from home, everybody gathers around hoping it's something to eat. So when Victor Rios from 2nd Squad got a humongous package, all the CA people came over to our tent to see what was in it. "I don't know what's in it," he said. "It ain't from my people in Albuquerque." "That's not the point," Barbara said. "The point is that it might be edible. Open it up." "Yo, it could be a chemical weapon or something," one of the construction guys said. Victor looked at the return address. It was from Wyoming. "I bought a toy monkey from Wyoming on eBay," he said. "But it was like a little thing, man."
"A monkey?"
Jonesy pulled his head back and squinted his eyes.
"You mean like a cheap kind of monkey?"
"When I was a kid, my abuela gave me a monkey to wear around my neck," Victor said. "It wasn't more than an inch high and it was carved in ivory. She said it would bring me luck. I never got shot as a kid, so when I saw the monkey on eBay I made a bid on it."
"Open it up," Jonesy said.
Victor didn't like any attention and I could see he was embarrassed as he unwrapped the package. Sure enough, it was a monkey. Big sucker, maybe 4 feet high. It was a real monkey, only dead and stuffed. Harris started cracking up big time and some of the construction people got on their headsets and started calling people over to come see Victor's monkey. Meanwhile, Victor was uncomfortable, but reaching that point where being uncomfortable was going to spill over into being mad. "I'm not eating him," Barbara said, and started off. Captain Miller had heard that something was going on and came to take a look. She examined the monkey and announced that it was an African vervet. Victor was shaking his head. When he found the letter that came with the monkey, he started reading it and then threw it down. The construction guy, a big, round-faced dude who looked about 12, picked it up and read it. "I am so proud of you boys and what you are doing for our country," it says. "So I am sending you this monkey instead of the smaller one you won in the eBay auction. Enjoy." Some people are just stupid. Victor was really mad. "Who's the monkey going to ride with?" Marla asked.
"Why don't you shut up?"
Victor said. "No, really, who's he going to ride with?" Marla asked again.
"First Squad'll take him."
Victor looked up at Marla to see if she was putting him on. I looked at her too. She wasn't. She was leaning over, taking a good look at the monkey. "You can have him," Victor said.
"Okay."
To me, the monkey looked creepy. I don't like dead things and the monkey was dead, but he was on a stand with a rod up his back so he didn't look, well, maybe he looked dead because he knew he was dead, but his eyes were open. He was grayish brown and the front of his face was black. Marla seemed really interested in the thing, though, and after asking Victor if she could really have it, took it away with all the packaging. There was a ball game on television, a rerun of the Mets' sixth game against Boston from 1986, and we watched that,
But all the time I was thinking about Victor wearing a monkey around his neck for good luck. The rest of the day went smoothly, and when we went to chill I asked Marley if she really wanted the monkey to ride with us.
Who?
Sergeant Yusarian?
Sergeant who?
Yusarian, Marla said. That's the name we gave him.
He don't look like no Arab monkey to me, Jonesy said.
That's not an Arabic name, Marla said. It's from a novel about World War II called Catch 22. Yusarian was the central character.
Well, Oprah Winfrey got her name from the Bible, Jonesy said.
So I guess we can have a monkey with a name from a novel. That made as much sense as Jonesy usually made. We got back from chow and the nets to put over our tent flaps had arrived. We had asked for them so that we could keep the flaps open and maybe catch a breeze. We had one air conditioning unit which we could hook up to the generator, but the generator made so much noise and messed up the air so much we didn't use it. But nobody wanted the flaps open at night, so we decided to wait until morning to put the nets up. I told Victor that the women had named the monkey Sergeant Yusarian and that the name was from a book called Catch 22. Victor said that it was stupid to give a monkey a name. I thought he just didn't want too much attention.
Hey, women do that kind of thing, I said.
Why do we have to do this?
Captain Miller was pissed, as per usual. I think the brass is handing us around because they're trying to sell some of the old-timers on the idea of civil affairs, Captain Cole said. Everybody knows about us, but for some of the unit commanders it's still a hard sell. They think we are just propaganda for the press.
We've built an army around the concept that we're more macho than anybody in the freaking world, Captain Miller said. Then when we screw up in operation you send the women out to make nice.
We don't know if they screwed it up.
Jonesy was putting on his mall vest and checking his ammo. We know they bombed a target and some civilians were killed. But the way the people fighting us dress, they could have been soldiers too.
If they're sending us, Marla chipped in, they screwed it up.
One of our planes might have taken out one of the Red Crescent ambulances, Captain Cole said. It'll probably be on Al Jazeera for the next 6 months. I remember the time we were attacked by guys hopping out of an ambulance. They were in an ambulance, in civilian clothes, and still had fired on us. I thought about the Marines who were killed on the road back to the bubble, and suddenly I didn't want to leave the tent. We took 1st and 2nd squads and the women from the medical squad with Captain Miller complaining at the top of her voice. I guess that was the way she handled things. We loaded up 3 Humvees. One pulled a water buffalo, a 400-gallon water carrier that could be hitched onto the back of a truck. Coles drove the Humvee pulling the water and the 2 medics rode with him. Ahmed went along to interpret. In the seat next to me, dressed up in a mall vest with sergeant stripes, was Yusarian. Jonesy was behind the wheel and it took us an hour and a half to reach the village, which was just outside of Al-Hamir. I didn't know how anybody could live in such a desolate area. Signs of war were everywhere, burned out vehicles, spent shells, trees that had been hit by bombs and now seemed to twist their way out of the pockmarked earth. The most impressive thing around was a huge terraced mound that looked like something from another world. We stopped to take a closer look at it. I heard Ahmed calling it a ziggurat. The red brick mound seemed almost to shimmer in the bright sunlight. The ancient Mesopotamians built shrines on top of them, Ahmed said.
Read that in the guidebook.
That's one of the spooky things about this country, Marla said. Half of the stuff here was built within the past 2 or 3 years and the other half has been here for 5,000 years. When we reached the area we were looking for, it was 1300 hours. There were some military trucks, including some water buffaloes, and 30 or 40 soldiers. Coles talked to them and found out that the people in the village didn't want to have anything to do with us.
They're not sure if they're afraid or just pissed off, Coles said.
Who are they?
Marla asked.
The 422ND, Coles answered. They're repairing some damage to the village's water supply. The 422ND Civil Affairs Battalion was the main CA support group attached to the 3RD Infantry. They had regular missions and their own agenda while we were just a flying squad. First squad and all talked about trying to switch units once things calmed down.
Did anybody talk to the local sheik?
Miller asked.
Captain Cole shrugged. Miller saw some Iraqi women and started toward them. Ahmed went with her, and me and Jonesy followed a few steps behind them. Marla, who had dismounted, went back to the Humvee. "Yo, Bertie, check out Miller," Jonesy said. Captain Miller had taken off her helmet and was running her fingers through her hair as she talked to the women. She had said she didn't like being paraded as a woman, but she understood that it did make a difference. I saw Miller talking directly to one Iraqi woman. The captain nodded a few times, and then came over to us. "We're invited into one of the houses for tea," she said. "One of the women speaks English and I think she's an American." Captain Cole said he wasn't going in, which surprised me. He told me to go in with the two medics, and Marla. "How come you don't want to go in, sir?" I asked. "I think you can handle it," Coles answered. What was happening, I thought, was that the humanity we were supposed to be showing the Iraqis was wearing thin. I didn't know who my enemy was over here, what rock he might pop out from which window he might shoot. I didn't know which of the figures in robes down to their ankles were praying for peace and which were planting bombs on the side of the road. Half of the electricity in the entire country was out, and even the electricity that was supposed to be all right didn't work most of the time. The house was small, two floors, but the top floor looked too small to be a regular living space. We went into a room that was lit by an oil lamp and whatever light came through the window. The woman who directed us to the low tables was young, maybe 30 at the most, with a thin, pleasant face that would have been pretty except for the sadness in her eyes. I thought she could have been an American. She didn't have much of an accent as she asked us to be seated. One of the other women brought a large pot and placed it in the middle of the table. The smell of tea, very strong, quickly filled the room. "Do you want to search my house?" the first woman asked me. "I see you are looking so hard." "No," I said. "You speak very good English," Captain Miller said. The woman nodded. We were served the tea in glasses and I remembered my grandmother telling me how she used to go down from Harlem to the Lower East Side when she was young and drink tea from glasses instead of cups. "We were told that there were children injured here," Captain Miller said. "We're very sorry." The woman spoke to the others, who all turned and looked at Captain Miller. Captain Miller looked back at each woman in turn. "You say I speak good English," said the woman who had invited us in. "My name is Halima Telfa. My friends call me Holly. I studied at the University of Washington in Seattle for 3 years and got my degree in biology there. I learned English at the university and at the hotel I worked in to support myself. The Hotel Meany. I thought it was a funny name for a hotel. I was very respectful of Americans. I thought you were a wonderful people. You were so free you didn't even know what to do with your freedom. Your women are free. Your men are free. Your children are free. I had so much respect for you and for your country." "We have respect for your country too," Marla said. "I don't think you even know my country," Halima said. "Can you tell us what happened?" Captain Miller asked. "Were there children injured?" "When the fighting started, when the invasion started, the young men who lived here, there weren't many, debated among themselves what they should do. They didn't know why you wanted to kill them. They asked that question, 'Why do they want to kill us?' They decided that they would put themselves at your mercy. They would wait until you came and see what you would do. Then some Ba'athists came and told our men it was their duty to fight and save their country." "The Ba'athists?" I asked. "The nationalist mob," she said. "Saddam's party. Did they come in a Red Crescent truck?" Marla asked. "No, it was just a regular truck. I think on the side it was painted something about soft drinks. The Ba'athists said that our young men should go to the capital to get orders. They belonged to the local reserves but they wanted them to go to the capital because there was so much talk about surrendering to the Americans. We made cakes for our men and packed fresh fruit into bags for them to carry to Baghdad. We cried with them and laughed with them and told them to be careful. The children." She stopped and put her fingertips to her mouth as if to feel the weight of the words that were coming out. Then she took a deep breath and continued. "The children were excited. They are only children. Every event is great for them. The men all got into the Baathist's truck and the children waved them goodbye. An American plane flew overhead. One of the men, I think it was one of the Baathists, shot at it. The plane circled. The children watched. The truck started down the road carrying our sons and brothers and husbands. The plane circled and dropped one bomb or fired one missile or something. It hit the truck and there was a great explosion. The plane flew away. It had done its duty for the war that day. The truck was only 300 meters down the road. We ran toward it. The children ran faster. But there was nothing left but pieces of bodies. One little girl began to scream. The horror of it swept over them all but one little girl whose brother was in the truck. She found what was left of him and tried to pull him home. Are they hurt, you ask? Yes, they are wounded deep inside. It is not something children should see. The Americans have come and the killing has begun, Halima continued. Her low, flat voice was barely above a whisper. There is so much killing that there is no place left in our hearts to hold our grief or our anger. Now the children are asking the same question as their brothers, why have you come to kill us? I'm sorry, Captain Miller said. I'm very sorry. Is there anything we can do to help? Treat our lives as if they are as precious as your own, Halima said. That's all we ask. I felt torn in 100 directions. The sadness in Halima's voice bothered me, but then I thought about the village men who had been killed, and remembered her saying that they were going to Baghdad to get ready to fight Americans. There was a lot less room in my heart for grief too. I thought Halima knew what I was thinking, because she kept looking in my direction. Are you ever going back to America? I asked. Who knows? She said. I don't dare make the predictions I made when I was a child. We finished the tea and went outside. Captain Miller asked again if there was anything we could do and Halima asked if we had any toothpaste. We didn't but Miller said we would get her some. Since the bombing began, it's become such a luxury to brush your teeth, Halima said. I feel guilty just thinking about it. There was a boy standing in the doorway. 9, maybe 10, and thin, he leaned against the side of the open door. The sun slanted across his legs and I saw that he was barefoot. Under one foot there was a soccer ball. I made a kicking motion and held my hands up. He looked at me for a long moment and then gently nudged the ball in my direction. I walked over to the ball and kicked it back. Another boy came out of the shadows, followed the ball to where it had rolled against the wall, and kicked it back to me. They couldn't help being kids. No matter what happened, they were still children. I remembered Sergeant Yusarian and motioned for the first kid to come over. He went with me to the Humvee and I pointed inside. He looked and jumped back quickly. Then he looked again. He reached in and touched Yusarian on the arm and saw that he didn't move. The smile on the kid's face was brilliant. White teeth and a brown face enjoying a moment of ridiculous peace. Yes. He turned toward the houses and called out. I don't know where all the kids came from, but there were soon 7, 5 boys and 2 girls, and one of the boys was chattering something in Arabic. One by one they looked into the Humvee and the braver ones touched Yusarian. Then the first kid turned to me and spoke in Arabic. He wants to know if you play football, Ahmed said. I knew he meant what we called soccer in America and I told Ahmed to tell him I knew a little about the game. Omar says he wants to play a game against the Americans, Ahmed said. Okay. It was me, Jonesy, Captain Coles, and 2 guys from the 422 ND against 5 Iraqi kids. We set up goals about 50 feet apart. Some of the Iraqi adults came out and stood on the side. One woman sat at her window with her arms on the sill. It reminded me of the black women in Harlem who would sit in the windows and watch the kids playing in the street. The Iraqi boys were either better than we thought they should have been or we were worse. Much to the amusement of Marla, they scored a goal past a lunging Captain Coles. We were weighed down with body armor and combat boots. The Iraqi kids, barefooted and dressed in nightshirts, flew around us. We played for nearly 30 minutes before Coles, mercifully, said we had to leave. Omar, the boy who had been standing in the doorway, said something to me, making sure it was loud enough for Ahmed to hear. He said any Iraqi could beat an American any day, Ahmed said. And maybe you could get the monkey to play next time. I said that next time we would win. It was something to say. I patted the boy on his hand and he pushed my hand away and stood up straighter, almost defiantly. Okay, I could deal with that. The soldiers from the 422nd seemed like really good guys. They said that they would try to build a goalpost for the kids when they finished getting the water pumps working. We let the villagers empty the water buffalo. They brought out jars, buckets, even a few pots, and took as much water as they could carry. Back to Baghdad. I was glad to be back in the green zone, back to feeling safe. Coles read us his report. It said that there was no friendly fire incident, and that the village guys could be called enemy combatants. It all looked good on paper, but I knew that Miller would have trouble with it. I was beginning to understand where she was coming from. She didn't have any easy answers, but she didn't need them. Back at the tent, Jones, he peeled off his boots and socks and collapsed on his cot. His feet stunk, so he poured some water on them. Yo, Bertie, how'd you like playing against those kids? It was okay. I really liked it, Jonesy said. That's what I want life to be about. I thought life was going to be about the blues, I said. I'm going to be playing the blues at night, Jonesy said. I got to find something to do in the daytime. That's why I'm over here. So what do you think of these Iraqis? I asked. It's like my Uncle Herbert used to say. Jonesy propped himself up on one elbow. You don't need to be around nobody you got to watch all the time unless you're making love to them. And God knows this Georgia boy ain't making love to nothing over here. Sergeant Harris and Jonesy got into a stupid shouting match that almost ended up in a fight. We were watching some cop program, the usual stuff with police dealing with low-level street crime. The cops were picking up prostitutes and Harris said that in a way most women weren't much more than whores. They get a man to support them and then they just sit back and watch television, he said. Yo, man, you got to show more respect than that, Jonesy said. Your mama is a woman. No, you got to watch yours, Harris said. I'm a sergeant, fool. You also sounding like your brain is AWOL, Jonesy said. We over here fighting with women. Harris jumped up from where he had been sitting, pushed Jonesy up against the wall, and drew his fist back as if he was going to punch him. I grabbed Harris from the back and spun him around while Victor and Evans jumped in front of him. I'll kill you and that little jerk. Harris was spitting as he talked. Hey, we're over here together, man, Evans said. You going to grow you some eyes in the back of your head? Jonesy was still against the locker as he shouted at Harris. Cause you're gonna need them. Why? Why? Harris balled his fist up again. You going to sneak up on me? Huh? Huh? No, because your butt is in a combat zone and you're going to need somebody to be watching your back, Jonesy said. I don't need you. Harris spat on the ground and then pushed by me toward the door. Nobody said anything. We had all seen it, but there wasn't anything to do but to get over it. I wondered if we would. You could report him, Evans said. Or shoot him when he goes to sleep, I said. Let it go, Jonesy said. Every dog gets his day. We sat around for a while, each of us thinking how we would have handled the situation. I knew that most of us wouldn't have had to. Harris had picked the smallest dude in the unit to jump on. There was no way he would have done it back in the world. I hadn't thought about it much, but Jonesy was right. We needed one another to get out of this war alive. We needed one another and a whole lot of luck. When Harris came back in, Pendleton told him he was wrong to be hitting a member of our unit. You want a piece of me? You want a piece of me? Harris stood up, glowering at Pendleton. Pendleton was a big, slow-talking white boy who could have broken Harris in half and everybody knew it. We just waited until Harris got his 30 seconds of showgo time and sat himself down again. Some of the guys in our unit got along well. The others were okay but they didn't hang out much. But we were all living through the same things, seeing the same fighting, feeling the same moments of boredom and terror. We were used to looking for one another in the mess tent, and expected to see one another in the mornings. There wasn't any room for any BS. Coles came in just after sunset and told us that we were going to be escorting some intelligence guys out to a place in the Ruz Alpha district before daybreak in the morning. He asked if anything was wrong, and after Jonesy said no, we all said no. "Look, I'm really not volunteering you guys," Coles said. He looked around a bit more. He knew something was wrong but couldn't figure out what, so he left. Morning came long before it was supposed to. We were barely dressed when Coles came into the tent. He looked around to see that we were all dressed and ready to go, and then brought in the two special ops guys who were with the intelligence unit. Darcy and Marla came in with them. "Guys, this is Lieutenant Davis, and this is Corporal Lawler," Coles said. "They'll explain the mission." Lawler had a square head and a short haircut. He looked like a Nazi from an old World War II movie. "We got some information from the confession box that we thought we should check out," he said. "The confession box?" Darcy sucked her teeth and looked away. The confession box was a booth the intelligence unit had set up. They paid the Iraqis who anonymously visited the box for information on insurgents. Most of the information intelligence got was bogus. But every once in a while something valuable was passed on. "Anyway," Lawler went on, "the information is that there's an IED factory in the old city area. We're going to pay a surprise visit and see what we find." "Who's translating?" Coles asked.
"I will be," Davis said. Marla rolled her eyes up and away.
"Look, let me give you people a few clues." Davis's jaw tightened, which made a white line across the bottom of his face. "We won this stand-up-and-fight war. That was over when we reached Baghdad. This is different. We're getting guys killed every other day by roadside bombs. These people here have been at war for the last 20 or so years. Before they invaded Kuwait, they were fighting with Iran. Intelligence estimates that there are over 2 million unspent artillery shells and mines spread across Iraq. Each one of them can be rigged into an IED. If 1% of them worked, 1%, they could kill 20,000 of our people. Are you with me? Hey, man, you want to catch the next train out of here?" Jonesy asked. "They've got the weapons. And yeah, they're crude, but they can kill you just as effectively as a sophisticated weapon. They've got the weapons all over the country, and the technology to arm them is spreading. That's where you come in. We've got guys to jump over tall buildings and run through fire. We've got guys who can shoot the balls off an anorexic flea. We need some soldiers with people skills and with insights. And from what I've heard, that's what you bring to the table. So you're going to be looking for these shells?" Marla asked. "If we can find artillery shells, that would be good," Davis said. "But we're looking for the people who have the technology. If we find electrical wires, detonators, clock assemblies, cell phones, then we'll know we're getting close."
"Cell phones?"
"They hook the cell phones up so that when the phone receives a signal, it sends an electrical impulse to a detonator instead of the ringer," Lawler said. "So if you come across an IED, and the guy who put it there sees you," Jonesy was scratching his crotch, "all he got to do is to make a call and he got your number."
"You got it," Davis said.
"More scary crap. We started putting on our gear and I made sure all my body armor was strapped down tight. I had heard about IEDs being wired up for remote and even being thrown off a bridge, but it looked like it was getting more and more high-tech. It was like the Iraqis were getting better at killing us and we were standing still. What happened between you and Harris?" Coles asked Jonesy as we mounted up.
"Nothing."
"It didn't sound like nothing," Coles said. "Hey, Captain, if I go to the confession box and tell you what Birdie dreams, about how much can I get?" Marla leaned against the side of the Humvee with one foot on the ammo can. "If it saves lives, Marla, it's worth looking into," Coles said. "I'd rather meet up with an IED on my terms rather than on the bad end of some 19-year-old kid making a name for himself at my expense." Headquarters had set up a booth for Iraqis to complain or make suggestions. The guys in the 3RD had started calling it the confession box because the soldier taking the information sat on one side of a wall and the person giving it sat on the other. If they gave us any useful information about insurgents or plots, we would pay them for the information. Word got around Baghdad quickly and every Iraqi that needed a few bucks was showing up with a long story, or a short one, about how he had seen three guys plotting to take over the Green Zone or building a weapon of mass destruction. It got to be such a joke that one guy actually said that he had seen someone put explosives inside a goat and it was going to run wild through the barriers. We were set to go but I had to go back to pee and so did Coles, so first squad was the last one ready. An infantry squad from the 3RD went with us, split into two Humvees, one in front of the convoy and one in back. Their vehicles had iron plates on the sides. "Bertie, hold Yusarian's hand," Marla said. "He gets scared when we go out in the middle of the night." We headed east and then circled back around the Green Zone toward the Old City section. We had been told that the Iraqis who were pretty well off lived in Old City before the war. The Iraqis who were really rich lived on the outskirts of the city in walled homes with guards. Jonesy was half humming, half singing something and I asked him what it was because it didn't sound much like the blues. "Survivor," he said. He was always rocking when he drove and also hunched forward toward the wheel. "When you were peeing," Marla said, "that was the Monkees theme song. Destiny's Child put it out." I could hardly see the Monkees' face because somebody had put a helmet on its head. I hoped God wouldn't think it was funny to let me die sitting next to a monkey. The first Humvee driver knew his way pretty well and we reached the Old City area in quick time. We stopped, killed the engines, and were told to dismount and get our night vision goggles ready. Crap. Iraq is dark at night and the only thing you're going to see with the night vision goggles is something that's trying to kill you. The streets where we had stopped were narrow. Perhaps a Humvee could get through but there was no way we were going to take a chance. If some guy popped out with an RPG in those narrow alleys you were toast. The houses usually had a courtyard behind a fence. The fence was locked with either a deadbolt or a bar across the entire door and if you had to bust through, you woke up the entire neighborhood. Once you broke through the fence, if you couldn't climb over it, you had to find the door. That would be a tough mother to crack as well. They act as if they're living in New York City, Jonesy had said. I didn't have a comeback for that. The officer from the 3RD placed his men at each corner of the house. I felt like peeing again as I watched them crouch into position. Two of the guys went toward the outer fence. They knelt together for a split second and then one of them went over. I held my breath for a long second, and then saw the front fence open. So far, so good. The Humvees were on the outside perimeter of the operation. If the thing went down wrong we were to retreat to the vehicles. I thought of Marla and the turret. She had the squad gun ready and her 9 cocked. Watch those index fingers. Watch those index fingers. The officer from the 3RD's voice was a loud whisper. I checked my finger and took it out of the trigger housing. Don't kill anybody who didn't need killing. Me and Jonesy went with two infantry guys, one of them carrying a ramming tool, to the left side of the house, and Harris and Victor went to the right, looking for side doors. We found one and the infantry guys went up to it and pushed gently. Then they clicked into their radios, knelt on one knee, and waited. I got down on one knee and Jonesy squatted. I heard the voice in the radio and the infantry guys stood, waited a second, then hit the door with the tool. Bam. Nothing. Bam. It broke partway. I imagined whoever was inside reaching for their AK-47. Bam. The door broke open and the two infantry guys moved in quickly, one to either side of the room. I was scared shitless as I went through the door into my left. The room was lit up as a nightlight flooded the room, making the whole place seem kind of a spooky green through my goggles. I pushed them up onto my helmet. The rooms were in a circle around a hallway. In the hallway there was a stairwell, not much more than a ladder going up to the second floor. The infantry dude yelled something. It might have been Arabic or I might have just misunderstood him. He fired into the wall, and the next thing he called out I knew. Americans. He was up the stairwell in a heartbeat and the guy with him was close enough to run up his back. They were screaming at the tops of their voices, trying to take command of the situation. By the time the first two had reached the second deck, three more infantry guys had come in. One went up the ladder while the other two started checking out spaces on the ground floor. "These guys are scaring me and they're on my side," Jonesy said. There was more shouting upstairs and then a guy shouted down the well. "Control. Clear on the first floor," was the answer. 2 minutes later, one of the infantry guys came down followed by two men, two women, one of them holding a baby, and three small children. Their officer came in, checked as they sat the Iraqis down in the inner hallway, and sniffed his approval. Then he told the men to start their search. "Check the upper floor first," he said. The two intelligence guys from the 422nd came in and started talking to the Iraqis. There were a lot of shrugs and palms up gestures indicating that they didn't know what we were talking about. One of the men kept squinting toward Davis, who was doing most of the talking, and I could tell Davis was repeating the questions, slowly and deliberately. "What's he saying?" Cole asked. "He wants to know who's going to pay for his door," Davis answered. "He says he doesn't know anything about any weapons. He's an accountant, but we blew up his bank." "Man, this is just a wild goose chase," Harris said. "We just busted up some more damn doors and almost killed some more people for nothing." They finished searching the top floor, I could hear them throwing things around, and then came downstairs. The baby started crying and the woman who held it began to rock her gently. The woman was pretty. I couldn't tell how old, but she had huge eyes that I would have loved to have been looking into under different circumstances. The two men kept shrugging their shoulders and shaking their heads. Once in a while they spoke to each other and Davis would yell at them to stop. The older woman was crying softly. She didn't answer any questions and looked away anytime Davis spoke to her. It was as if they couldn't believe what was happening to their lives. Davis asked questions for another 15 minutes and then asked us to search the Iraqis. He told us to get one of the women to search their women. Coles called Marla and told Jonesy and Harris to stay with the vehicles until she got back. Harris muttered something under his breath and left with Jonesy. God, I didn't like that sucker. I also didn't like searching people. I had been stopped on 136th Street once, just outside the County Cullen Library, by two plainclothes cops who had searched me. I knew what it felt like. Embarrassed that I had to stand there with my hands in the air while strangers patted me down and went through my pockets, humiliated because they were assuming power over me and I couldn't do a thing about it. I felt I knew how the Iraqi men felt as I searched them. They were just wearing shirts, nothing under them, and I could see they didn't have any weapons on them. Davis saw it too, but he was taking out his embarrassment on the enemy. Marla came in and she searched the women quickly and found nothing. "I'll get his name and address so we can compensate him for the damage," Davis said. We stood around while Davis took the guy's name and address. Davis asked the infantry guys how much damage there was upstairs and they said none. "Go check," Davis said. Marla was looking around in the kitchen area. She stared at a wooden tub. "We'll make sure that everything damaged is noted so we can pay for it," Davis was saying to one of the Iraqis. "I'm sorry that we disturbed you." The man was shaking his head in disgust. "Captain Coles," Marla called. She lifted a handful of flour and let it fall through her fingers. "Dumplings of mass destruction?" Coles asked. "No, just flour," Marla said, lifting a handful and letting it run through her fingers. She did it again. "And detonators." Everything stopped. Marla pulled out some of the cord and Davis told her to stop. I went over and looked at the tub. There were thin light blue tubes visible. Each had two wires, one red and one yellow sticking from one end. "Jesus. Oh, Jesus." Davis was visibly shook. I looked at the Iraqi man who had been shaking his head. Now he was standing with his head down, biting his lip. Davis told Coles to post the CAs as security. As we went out, the other infantry guys piled into the house. I couldn't wait to fill Marla in on what had happened. "You mean they had finished searching and I was the only one that found the stuff?" "The only one," I said. By the time the three RD guys had brought out the two males, blindfolded and cuffed, and got them into their vehicles, I could see a streak of light in the distance. It was almost a new day. The sound of the muezzin, calling the Islamic faithful to their morning prayers, lifted eerily across the rooftops.
Hey, Marla, that was just luck, right?
I asked as we turned the Humvee around to head back to our camp.
No, I like to cook, she said.
One foster home I was in had me doing most of the cooking. I didn't mind it. But nobody smoothed the flour out like that on top.
That's all show and tell, man.
I'm not going to live through this war. These people around me, Marla, Jonesy, Victor, Pendleton, even Harris, they're all better soldiers than I am. I would have never noticed that flower. Not in a thousand years. But I felt good as I undressed and fell across the bed. I hadn't been shot at, and first squad had found the detonators. Maybe we had even saved some lives. But then I started thinking about the Iraqi women, one crying and one rocking the baby. I remembered how bad I had felt for them, only to find out that they were in a family that probably would have killed me if they had had the chance. Then I started thinking about Marla in a foster home. What was that like? She was so open at times, but she gave only glimpses of who she was.